Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. The Labor Department released new figures today showing that jobless claims rose for the second straight week. But Treasury Secretary John Snow is keeping his job. After weeks of speculation that Snow might be leaving the administration, the White House says the president has asked him to stay. Job creation and maintaining a strong economy are just two important tasks ahead for President Bush. He'll discuss these and other issues during a two-day summit scheduled for next week. Well, joining us now from the New York offices of The Economist is Lane Green, global agenda correspondent. And Lane, what do you make of the announcement that Snow is staying on?
Well, I think the most important thing to remember about Snow is that he's seen as a Bush loyalist. The trend in the administration's changes has been that loyalists are being promoted and people who have been a bit off message are finding new employment at the moment.
Well, he may be loyal, but some analysts are saying that he never learned how to talk to the market. What does that mean?
Well, they're worried about the volatility, particularly in the dollar, and there's a belief that he may be subtly, that the administration and him as the spokesman, may be subtly letting the dollar slide. But this is causing a lot of worry for people, especially abroad, who hold lots of dollar-denominated assets.
Let's talk about that drop in the value of the American dollar. American stores are flooded with people from Europe and overseas who are taking advantage of the great sales here. But what are the concerns about a dropping dollar value?
Well, there's a number of concerns. The dollar's drop is being fed by two things. One is our major budget deficit going on here, and the other is, of course, the trade deficit we're running. If we continue to let the dollar slide too hard, that could cause foreign holders of dollars to bail out of their dollar-denominated assets. That could make a gentle slide turn into a tumble, and that could do all kinds of things, including fueling inflation and firing up interest rates, sending up interest rates here at home.
What do you mean? They would cash in on them?
Yeah, essentially foreigners hold quite a lot of assets that are denominated in dollars, and their willingness to buy things denominated in dollars, like, for example, treasury bonds, has been what's kept the dollar strong despite the current account deficit. But if they start to feel like the dollar is losing value, they may try to outdo one another in getting rid of the dollars before someone else does, before they lose their value. And if everybody starts to do that at the same time, that's what leads to very sharp drops in a currency.
But you mentioned that the Bush administration might be allowing the dollar to drop. Why would they do that?
Well, we might decide to gently allow the dollar to drop because that would be a natural way to break the trade deficit, to put a break on it. Because as we let the dollar drop, that means that American goods become relatively cheaper abroad, and that means foreigners will be buying more of them, and it makes imports more expensive here at home. So that's a natural mechanism to curb that trade deficit.
Well, the Wall Street Journal editorialized that the entire Treasury Department has been out of power. They wrote in an editorial, "A Treasury Department is a terrible thing to waste." Do you see the president and his secretary for a second term, Secretary Snow, maybe making a bigger push on issues in the new term?
Well, there's no doubt they want to make a big push on two major economic issues. One of those is reforming the tax code, and another is the partial privatization of Social Security. Now, clearly what they feel like they want is someone who will be strongly on message, but what they may need is a stronger advocate, not someone who just repeats the party line, but someone who can really twist arms. And the perception is that Snow is good at the first job, but he's not so good at the arm twisting.
In fact, there were reports that Vice President Dick Cheney was interviewing candidates for Secretary Snow's job. That led to the rumors and speculation that he was going to be exiting. How long do you think he's going to hold on to it?
I can't say how long he'll stay in his job, but one thing that's clear about what's gone on is that this weakens Secretary Snow because he was known to be perhaps on the outs, and now that he's being kept on, it's known that it's only after some speculation about it. I think it'll weaken his credibility, maybe with the markets and certainly with the policymakers that he's going to have to lean on to get the president's agenda passed.
Well, for now, Secretary Snow is holding on to his job, but as we said at the outset, jobless claims rose for the second straight week. Thousands of others are going to file for claims. Your take on that?
What we're seeing is fairly strong economic growth without the creation of a lot of jobs. And what that's probably due to is strong productivity. Mm. Productivity, pretty much by definition, means that we're getting more economic output out of the same number of workers.
They're working more hours
and they're working more efficiently, which is a good thing. If we're a productive economy, that is a very strong fundamental to the American economy. But what it means is that more people are getting more output. That means fewer jobs.
And eventually, too many people out of work trumps the productivity.
In a political sense, yes.
Lane Green, Global Agenda Correspondent for The Economist. Lane, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Well, Walmart employs 1.2 million workers in the U.S., although even the company reportedly admits a full-time worker may not be able to support a family on the wages paid. And perhaps with an eye on those unemployment numbers, other Americans may be holding on to their income. The world's biggest retailer had lower than expected sales growth last month, and Walmart also lowered its forecast for December. And to get more shoppers in, slashed prices even further. You can get a DVD player for $28. So what's the future of the shopping behemoth? Joining us first, Professor Eugene Fram from the Rochester Institute of Technology. Professor, how do you interpret those Walmart sales numbers?
Well, I read those numbers as just a small downward blip. I think they got caught a bit napping, but outside of that, they're still on a roll.
Well, are the retailers possibly figuring out how to do Walmart and maybe creeping in on their market?
I think they caught Walmart napping a little bit. But Walmart this year is still estimated to approach, for the entire year ending January 31st, some $300 billion in sales.
How do they do that? Let's take that $28 DVD player. Mm-hmm. How can Walmart do that?
Well, one, they have huge buying power, so they get the absolute lowest cost. And in some instances, if they think it'll attract consumers to buy other things, they'll sell it below cost as a loss leader.
But isn't that, you know, what you call buying power, what some call intimidation of, you know, manufacturers, many of whom have moved right there to where Walmart's headquarters is just to curry favor. Some say that that power is what's putting other companies, FAO Schwarz, KB Toys, Toys R Us has shut down more than 100 stores, you know, literally putting them out of business.
But this has been the pattern of American capitalism for 100, 200 years. I see Walmart as the corporation of the 21st century. In the 20th century, you had General Motors and Sears. Just taking Sears as the retailing example, in the 1920s and 30s, Sears was the employer to work with. They had a huge fine retirement plan, but look at Sears today. Sears has declined, and Walmart has come in to take its place at the highest level that we've ever seen in terms of sales there.
A lot of people blame Walmart for the closing of, you know, favorite bookstores, small toy stores, destroying the quality of life in small towns. A lot of people blame Walmart for low wages in the retail industry. What's true about what the impact of Walmart?
Their wages are on a par with other retailers. In terms of causing the decline of the small retailers, yes. But the small retailers who can find a niche can survive. In terms of ecology, in some areas of the country, that has been a concern because they feel there are just too many big boxes there. So it's a variable issue and a situational issue, depending upon the particular area of the country, the politics in the area, and Walmart's position.
Walmart appeals to people looking for discounts. Presumably, these are people who work. Yet it's faced lawsuits from employees in more than three dozen states. Employees in Washington State have a class action lawsuit claiming Walmart changed pay records, you know, pretty much cheating them out of their wages. Federal prosecutors allege Walmart hired contract cleaning services in order to use low-wage illegal workers. There have been lawsuits from women who felt they weren't treated well. Why doesn't this seem to impact their sales, that they have this negative side?
Very simply, everybody, no matter where you are in the economic scale, loves a bargain. And Walmart offers significant bargains to a large number of people. The other thing I think in terms of employees we have to keep in mind is Walmart worldwide employs 1.5 million people. And I think they need to get a better handle on employing that large number of people.
Professor, one last question. We read in The Economist that the mathematics of big numbers says that Walmart's growth has to slow. And I found myself wondering, you know, how low, you know, on the other side of the ledger, how low can you go on a DVD player? I mean, at a certain point, you know, there's got to be a ceiling, how low you can go on prices and how big you can grow. Your thoughts?
Well, again, they can't go low on every of the 50,000 items that they may have in a super Walmart. What they lose on the peanuts, they make up on the popcorn. But I think Walmart has another 20 to 30 years to go before somebody's going to come along with a new wrinkle of some sort and is going to out-Walmart Walmart. It's bound to happen. It happened to Sears. It happened to Woolworth. Something will come along, and my crystal ball, which is as, probably as clear as yours, is that it's about another 20 or 30 years before you will see that.
I see China in my crystal ball. How about you?
Yes, that's going to be a big player. It's not only for supplying goods, but it's a huge market. And they are tailoring that market to the Chinese market. I was talking to a person who was in their food department in a super Walmart, and she said it smells exactly like a Chinese grocery store. So they are tailoring. They are tailoring these international stores very well.
Professor, thank you.
Thank you. It's nice talking to you.
Professor Eugene Frem teaches marketing at Rochester Institute of Technology in New York. Well, at the stroke of midnight this New Year's Eve, a system of quotas on imported textiles is set to expire. Now, right now, the U.S. limits the amount of clothing and textiles imported into the country in an attempt to protect domestic manufacturers. But when the new year begins, analysts expect a huge influx of goods from overseas to flood the U.S. marketplace. Where will these goods come from? You might have guessed it. China. Ailish McGarvey writes about these quotas in this month's American Prospect magazine. Ailish, we were just talking about Walmart, and in reading about China's economy, you know, China can produce things for 30 to 40% less than the U.S. can. They have lower labor costs. China sounds like the Walmart of countries.
Oh, interesting. That's true. China enjoys an incredible economy of scale. It's integrated industries when it comes to textiles, so which means its cotton and textile and apparel industries are all very closely knit, pardon the pun, together, mm-hmm. and they obviously have very cheap labor. But China also, what makes it a little bit different from a corporation, if you will, is China, the state is involved in a lot of quasi illegal, sometimes very dubious incursion into the economy, particularly the textile and apparel industry. So, for instance, Beijing often interferes with pricing and productions. It issues non-performing loans, which means these loans to businesses don't have to be paid back. Mm. China pegs its yuan, its currency, to the dollar, which, as you mentioned, results in a 30 to 40% price advantage in the U.S. market.
Now, tell us a little more about that. In other words, it's fixed?
Yes, so that everything that comes into the U.S. then enjoys a 30 to 40% discount. So pricing in the U.S. can't compete with that. Our currency is stronger than that.
Right. Well, Ailish, stay right there. We're going to continue our conversation with Ailish McGarvey about these textile quotas and what their expiration means for the world's manufacturers and for you. There's more ahead here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. With more on those quotas on imported apparel and textiles that are set to expire at the end of this year, China is expected to capitalize big time on the lowering of trade restrictions. Ailish McGarvey writes about these quotas in this month's American Prospect magazine. And Ailish, give us a bit of context here. When and why were these quotas put in place?
Well, in 1974, the original quotas under the multi-fiber arrangement were designed to help U.S. and European manufacturers. There were smaller, less developed countries like Sri Lanka that were creeping in on their market share. So the U.S. and Europe agreed to allow smaller countries to have a certain amount, this quota, a certain amount of the American and European market every year. Well, fast forward to 1993, And these smaller countries have enjoyed some success in textile and apparels and won a larger share of the global marketplace. So as the WTO is forming, U.S. and Europe agree to phase out these quotas entirely over 10 years. Fast forward to today, and an emerging coalition of these same small countries, but including U.S. manufacturers and even European manufacturers, are clamoring to keep the quotas in place because no one in 1993, if you can believe this, was calculating the huge market share that China would eventually take over. China wasn't even a part of the talks. It wasn't on anybody's radar screen. So it seems like, as I write in the article, an oversight of just almost Herculean proportion. It's incredible that that wasn't there.
Explain, first of all, who takes which side in this dispute, retailers. I would imagine they want the quotas lifted in order to bring in more goods that are made for less by workers overseas, and that would be good for consumers. Places like Walmart could sell them for less.
Yes. Right now with quotas, even a huge Walmart has to only a certain percentage of its textile and apparel purchases can be from China. And once the quotas are lifted, they could do everything in China. And that's what the evidence is indicating they're planning on doing. And they would say that they can pass along a lower cost to consumers.
Is there any kind of loss, though, for a big retailer like Walmart? Is there anything in the debit column for them getting too dependent on China goods?
I think the cost is actually more clearly borne out in communities. In America, for instance, in the South, I did some work on the hosiery industry in North Carolina, and generations of people who've been able to live a good middle-class lifestyle with gainful employment are losing those jobs and ironically having to start working in places like Walmart because, you know, rural North Carolina in the mountains doesn't enjoy a strong service sector. There aren't these technology jobs there that people are often talking about manufacturing jobs being replaced with. If you think about this phenomenon taking place overseas in a place like Cambodia or Bangladesh, you're talking about incredibly gainful jobs that don't pay much by our standards, but that are really bolstering an emerging middle class in those nations. And the cost borne out there, by many accounts, is catastrophic.
Well, so these are manufacturers you're talking about.
Yes, indeed. When these quotas were put in place, places like Cambodia and Bangladesh got a certain share of the market, and they've been able to really exploit that. Cambodia is a fascinating story because only 5 years ago, the U.S. and Cambodia inked an agreement that links U.S. garment quotas to certified improvements in working conditions in Cambodia. So in exchange for a certain amount of the market share, they qualitatively improved their labor practices, which is a really big achievement. It's the only experiment like that that's ever taken place, and it, by all accounts, it's been a moral and economic success. And that will be destroyed. That arrangement will be gone at the stroke of midnight in 2005.
So to recap, you're saying manufacturers from North Carolina to Cambodia are opposed to dropping the U.S. quotas because their jobs will be wiped out. Can China really wipe out the workforce in a country?
Yes. China can do that. It's fascinating. Someone told me that a Bangladeshi official has argued that there are four other jobs in that nation that are directly dependent on each single apparel job, which is pretty amazing. The garment jobs employ half of the industrial workforce in Bangladesh. Now, this is an Islamic nation. This is a nation that's battling fundamentalism and major, major corruption. But, you know, the garment industry is a standout. It employs high numbers of women. It's helped change attitudes toward women in education and the workforce. It's tempered religious extremism. And these jobs, the only thing that's holding them there are these quotas. Turkey is another great example. I mean, the Bush administration holds Turkey up, rightly so, as a moderate Islamic democracy. It's the model that the administration envisions for a future Iraq, governed by a secular democracy. But textiles and apparels constitute a third of that industrial employment in Turkey, and it's 4 million jobs. As someone mentioned to me in my article, yank those out and the whole economy destabilizes, the nation experiences political unrest. And he said to me, what are we thinking? You know, this is a critical economic pillar in a nation where we really have a vested interest in seeing economic stability, and we're letting that fall away.
Well, as you mentioned, workers in North Carolina can at least find a lower paying job at Walmart, but I'm thinking people from other countries might get the same idea, you know, to come to the U.S., to come here and look for work.
Well, and Mexico is a great example of that because with NAFTA, one of the great ironies here is that this China, in terms of textiles, the China quotas being lifted kind of signaled a death knell for 1994 NAFTA. You know, a lot of these Mexican manufacturers of textile and apparels are in the northern part of the country. And absolutely, I think that that's, many labor economists would agree that that's something to look for, is that when these jobs are gone, people will try to be making it over here.
Well, a group of retailers, you know, store owners, have filed a lawsuit to block an effort by the Bush administration to add some additional quotas to replace the ones that are scheduled to be lifted. And some analysts say that Walmart, for instance, keeps prices down and therefore inflation in check because it has cheaper products. So do you see any upside to China being able to bring more goods that cost less to the U.S.?
I actually can't think of one from the U.S. perspective. It's good for China, obviously. And I think sometimes these conversations smack of xenophobia or real ultra-protectionism. And I think that China obviously has an enormous workforce that it has to productively employ. I think that is something we all need to be thinking about when we talk about these things. But the big picture here is, and the real question, I think, is price the only parameter? Are there hidden costs not being factored in? And interestingly, recently, 1970 Nobel laureate Paul Samuelson rocked the economic world with an article that he essentially asserted that the price paid for free trade is falling on workers and results in a net negative for the American people and workers even in emerging economies. So I do think that right now, even the academic world of economists are starting to really think hard about these bigger questions, as we're seeing this borne out with nations like China in real time.
Ailish McGarvey writes about China and the lifting of U.S. quotas on clothing imports scheduled for New Year's Eve in this month's American Prospect magazine. Ailish, thanks so much for talking to us about it.
Thank you for having me.
Well, tomorrow on Here and Now, more on supply and demand, this time Afghanistan's poppies and the heroin pipeline direct to the streets of Europe. That's tomorrow. Stay with us. There's more ahead, Here and Now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Just about the only official business left to conduct on Capitol Hill today is the lighting of the holiday tree. A few legislators are sticking around for that, but otherwise the 108th Congress is history, and the 109th, with a larger Republican majority in both houses, starts up next month. If the last session is considered one of the most poisonously partisan in history, to quote the Boston Globe, what might the next one be like? Joining us on the line from Washington is Gail Shattuck. She covers Congress for the Christian Science Monitor. Hello, Gail.
Hello.
And first of all, is that hyperbole, the most poisonously partisan, referring to the last Congress?
No. It's a term that many members use, and I think given the what's happened in the last Congress, it's justified. I think it's striking that the biannual civility retreat was canceled next year due to lack of interest, which gives you some indication of where members' thoughts are on this issue.
We remember one moment in particular where the vice president on the floor of a chamber used an expletive directed at another member.
Yes, and I think that's a sign of the tensions that have existed on a lot of fronts that concern judicial nominations. I think it's also very interesting because if you listen to conservatives talking about the next Congress, they feel that they've pushed a lot of their social issues as far as they can in the legislative process. For example, the vote on abolishing a late-term abortion procedure passed the Congress but was rolled back in the judiciary. So conservatives are saying that the most important fight in the 109th Congress is not going to be over laws. It's going to be over judicial nominations.
Hmm. Well, before we go forward, let's take a second and look back a little bit. Just tick off the 108th achievements despite this poisonous feeling that you describe.
I think the major achievement was last night when, after months of work, Congress passed the intelligence reform proposed by the 9/11 Commission. This was not a done deal at any point in the process. I think it is probably one of the most effective government commissions ever functioning, the 9/11 Commission. They not only wrote a report that became a bestseller that people talk about, but after the commission disbanded, they kept up the pressure on lawmakers to actually passed the bill, which is pretty much what happened intact this week.
But, you know, it's useful to compare the passage of the intelligence bill to, say, the passage of the Medicare bill earlier. The Los Angeles Times is saying that the passage of yesterday's reform bill is sort of a lesson for the president, because members are still angry at having their arms twisted to vote for the Medicare drug benefits last year. Remember that.
That's an excellent point. In fact, I'm hearing a lot of talk about that now. Remember, there were 25 Republicans who voted against that bill after a vote that stretched out almost 3 hours.
That's the Medicare bill.
The Medicare bill, and that was last November. They're coming back now. There were 67 of them who voted against the 9/11 Commission intelligence reform because they felt it didn't go far enough on border security. And they cite that Medicare vote saying, look, we voted for something once before that turned out badly. We wish we had stuck to our guns, and next time we will. So I think you're going to see, despite Republican numbers higher in the House and the Senate, also a lot more Republican independence that could make the president's job of getting an agenda through harder than it looks on paper.
Well, in fact, you've been describing rancor between Republicans and Democrats. Some would say that testiness between the White House and the Republican Party might be the most poisonous thing in the 109th.
It's not poison yet, but if you look at some of the early signs of what they're going to be pushing, I was fascinated by a report a couple of weeks ago by Mike Pence, who's an Indiana Republican, who's the new head of the Republican Study Committee. And he's talking about what the agenda will be. This is the largest conservative caucus and the most powerful caucus on the House side. He says, we're going to follow the president insofar as he limits government, but we want to roll back No Child Left Behind. We want to roll back Medicare. These are the president's two signature achievements. So I think you can anticipate much more feistiness in conservative ranks in a second term.
Well, some of the issues that are going to also arise in the second term, tax reform, Social Security privatization, immigration issues, is there the will in Congress to tackle these issues, given that the president doesn't have to run again? Many of them do.
And that's where the will comes from. You know, we all forget that there are also very important reauthorizations pending. Welfare, transportation, the Patriot Act has to be reauthorized. Parts of it are sunsetting. The Higher Education Act, the energy bill that's been languishing. These are all extremely important bills. It will take a lot of concerted effort to pass. And whether or not the situation in Iraq and budget deficits are going to eclipse all of that, it certainly puts a very high premium on the president's ability to work with Republicans.
You mentioned Iraq. How much will members of Congress be involved in how long that conflict goes on?
Very involved. You're already seeing members ramping up their travel to the area, expressing great concern, for example, over Secretary Rumsfeld's remarks yesterday about why it's taking so long to adequately armor American forces there. There was a strong reaction among especially conservatives on that point. So I think you'll see a lot of pushback on that front.
The 108th Congress passed the $388 billion omnibus spending bill. There were a lot of items tucked in there. Some were found out. For instance, a provision to allow congressmen to inspect the tax records of Americans. That was found and kicked out.
Mm-hmm.
Some are going to reveal themselves in the 109th Congress. Is there one that comes to mind?
My personal favorite is the Punxsutawney Weather Museum, which is a $100,000 earmark to support Groundhog Central Weather Museum. It's one of $25 billion in member earmarks in this legislation. And all the rest that, you know, when a bill is written as quickly as this one is, with as few hands involved, most of what's interesting has yet to be revealed.
Well, one of them that comes to mind for us, on a more serious note, has to do with federal funding of state agencies having to do with abortion education.
Exactly. This is part of how conservatives are moving a social agenda. It's a provision that would remove any federal sanction on a hospital or clinic that refuses, for conscience reasons, to offer abortion referrals. What you're seeing here is the beginning, it's part of an ongoing effort of social conservatives who can't get a full bill through to get pieces of what they want tacked on to other bills that are moving. And within a big omnibus bill that can't be amended and isn't debated, it's a perfect vehicle for this sort of thing.
Gail Chadha, congressional correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor. We will talk to you in the new congressional session.
I look forward. Thank you.
Still to come, a surgeon's view of medical care for U.S. soldiers wounded in action. You're listening to Here and Now. A fight over a photograph is all that stands between Northern Ireland and a new peace deal. For the past 3 months, British Prime Minister Tony Blair and his Irish counterpart Bertie Ahern have been overseeing peace talks to end the 30-year conflict between Northern Ireland's Catholic and Protestant factions. Under the deal, the IRA would agree to destroy all of its arms by Christmas. But the Protestant Democratic Unionist Party, or DUP, is demanding photographic evidence, and that's been the sticking point. Joining us on the line from London, Here Now is Michael Goldfarb. Michael, Prime Minister Blair has compared these negotiations to climbing a mountain. When you think you've reached the peak, you realize you have another peak. How much further do they have to go?
Well, it really is the matter of this photograph, Robin, and it could be a very long distance or it could be a somewhat shorter one. I mean, what's been going on is that for the last 2 years, the Good Friday Agreement, which created a power-sharing executive and assembly in Northern Ireland, effectively returned governance of the province to the people of Northern Ireland, has been parked by the British government because the IRA in the words of the unionists, had not met its full obligations in terms of decommissioning its arms.
Right.
We've had this intensive period of 3 months of negotiations in which it seemed as if we were finally going to get to a point where the IRA would make a final and complete act of decommissioning. And we, the press, were all led to believe that this would be happening in December before Christmas. And finally, yesterday, the two prime ministers had to come out in Belfast and say, we've taken it as far as we can now. And it's all stuck on this photograph.
A photograph doesn't seem like it would be that big a hurdle. What does it mean?
Well, the photograph, in the words of the IRA, this is actually not about verification and transparency that the arms have been destroyed. This is about humiliation. And they're concerned that the DUP, led by Ian Paisley, hardline, fire and brimstone Presbyterian preacher, really wants these photographs and will, you know, use them to humiliate the IRA and say, see, we beat them, we won the war, and so on.
Yeah.
And, you know, Paisley does give credence to Sinn Féin's view. I mean, on Monday he said, people who sin in public must repent in public. And last night after the talks broke down, he was in full fire and brimstone form.
They have brought murder and mayhem to this country, and I, for one, and my party, for one, are not going to be ruled or dictated to by IRA gunmen.
Well, with statements like that from Ian Paisley, it sounds as if there's a great deal of anger. Under these conditions, do you think a peace deal can go through?
You know, the two prime ministers seem to think so. And as if to prove how close all sides were, they took the unprecedented step of making public the draft agreement that everyone had agreed to, except for this photograph to verify that the IRA has completely destroyed its arsenal of weapons. And that's a pretty remarkable step. And it's the information contained in this draft agreement is pretty remarkable. It picks the Good Friday Agreement off the floor. The Catholic community has long been concerned about the policing of Northern Ireland, where the police are still overwhelmingly Protestant. It's a sectarian problem. It gives Sinn Féin a place on the commission which oversees policing in the province. It sets out a clear timetable for powering up the institutions of government in Northern Ireland, which people in both communities, this is what they really want. They want to govern themselves. They're a kind of special situation within the United Kingdom. And for 2 years, they've been ruled from London. They don't like that. Everything is out there. Everything was agreed except this one photograph. Now, today, what Sinn Féin said is, if you're very concerned, Ian Paisley, about verifying the full decommissioning of our weapons, then why don't you send a representative along with the body that observes these acts of decommissioning and verify it with your own eyes? You don't really need a photo. The problem is that they had to make that offer via the BBC because Ian Paisley refuses to speak to anyone in Sinn Féin.
So we're in a wait-and-see mode on that note, but it doesn't bode well for these two parties sitting next to each other in an eventual government.
Robin, it is going to be one of the wonders of the world if they ever get this sorted out. And it's very difficult to imagine Ian Paisley coming into the Assembly Chamber as the first minister of Northern Ireland's Assembly and turning to Gerry Adams, leader of Sinn Féin, who will be, because Sinn Féin is now the largest Catholic party, the deputy first minister of Northern Ireland, shaking his hands and saying, let's get to work.
Here now is Michael Goldfarb reporting from London. Michael, thank you.
Thank you, Robin.
You're listening to Here. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. With this update, police in Columbus, Ohio have identified the gunman in last night's fatal shooting at a nightclub. 25-year-old Nathan Gale shot and killed four people at a concert of the heavy metal band Damage Plan. Two others were wounded before Gale was shot dead by a police officer. Police say an officer was in the area at the time of the shooting and was able to respond quickly. Sergeant Brent Mull describes what that officer saw when he entered the club.
The shooter, apparently getting ready to shoot someone else. At that point, the officer engaged the suspect.
Among the victims was heavy metal guitarist Dimebag Darrell Abbott, formerly of the Grammy-nominated group Pantera. An unidentified witness at the club says it appears that the guitarist was the shooter's target.
He came up around the left side of the stage, just like he knew what he was doing, walked up, started screaming at Dimebag. Next thing you know, he pulls a gun and starts shooting him. I mean, he grabbed him, and I'd say probably 5-6 times shot him.
After Abbott was shot, the gunman then turned his gun into the crowd of more than 250. Police say they may never know the motive for the shooting. Darrell Abbott frequently graced the pages of guitar magazines, appearing in articles and advertisements for equipment he endorsed, and in readers' polls, where he often held one of the top 10 heavy metal spots. He also contributed to a column for Guitar Magazine, which has been compiled in the book Riffer Madness. Abbott was 38. Here's a bit of Pantera's song, Walk. Well, today, the New England Journal of Medicine is publishing an article called Casualties of War. It's one surgeon's view of military care for the wounded in Iraq and Afghanistan. The story is accompanied by a photo essay that shows medical personnel at work, as well as pictures of survivors' severe injuries, some of the most graphic images from the war in Iraq published to date. The report's author is Dr. R. Atul Gawande, surgeon at Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston and assistant professor of health policy and management at the Harvard School of Public Health. Dr. Gawande spoke this morning with Here and Now's Bob Oakes.
Your article says that more soldiers are surviving their wounds from the fighting in Iraq and Afghanistan. But why is that the case? What's different about the way the wounded are being treated in Iraq compared to, say, the Gulf War or Vietnam?
Yeah, the striking historic thing is that for more than 50 years, it's been 25% to 30% of the battle wounded who would die. And in this war, it's less than 10%, and that's a stunning, unprecedented achievement. They've done it partly because of the use of body vests, Kevlar body vests that protect the core, but also, very critically, because they've moved the surgical care to the front lines. In Vietnam, for example, if you made it to a surgical hospital, 98% lived, which meant that the fact that 25% died, it meant that those people never made it to surgical care. And that's one of the key innovations, is having these small units of just 20 people with only two or three surgeons traveling with the troops, setting up tiny hospitals very rapidly and moving right along.
This despite the fact that many of the injuries the doctors and the nurses, the medical teams are seeing are quite serious, considering we're hearing all the time about car bombings and other types of insurgent attacks injuring soldiers, creating blast wounds.
Yeah, I described the case, for example, of a young soldier who lost three limbs, part of their face, and had severe abdominal injuries. That was uniformly fatal, even as recently as the Persian Gulf War. But because they have now got the surgeons setting up right at the battle lines with these three tent units, two operating tables, can get going in an hour, they saved someone like this. And they do it by having really just damage control surgery, a short operation, 2 hours long, do enough to stop the bleeding, contain the contamination, do an amputation if you have to, and then ship them onward to Baghdad, Germany, or even Walter Reed. So this soldier survived those horrendous wounds in the course of three operations in 36 hours, one in Iraq, one in Germany, and then one in Walter Reed, all in less than 36 hours.
Your article also describes a shortage of medical personnel to carry out that triage system that you described on the ground in Iraq. How significant is the shortage?
Well, one of the things that really struck me in beginning to look at the data around this is they only have 120 surgeons in the Army and about an equal number available in the reserves. We're a country that has close to 10,000 surgeons, and the available pool of surgeons that they can attract is very small. At any given time, they've therefore been able to have about 30 to 50 in Iraq. All the surgeons have cycled through twice, and they're stretched so thin at this point that they even have plastic surgeons and urologists having to do trauma duty at the battlefront.
What can be done about that? Anything?
Well, the military has drawn up medical draft plans in case the president says that that's what would be necessary. But, of course, the president has ruled that out. So they're keeping the current soldiers on the current surgeons on extended duty like the other soldiers. They're trying financial inducements. But the supply, of course, of people signing up for reserves or going directly has dried up.
So is there a short-term solution to this or a long-term solution short of a draft?
If this war goes on for a year or more, it's very hard to see how they're going to be able to keep the supplies of the personnel for medical care going. The Selective Service has already pinpointed this as being the critical shortage area that they have. But it's so politically untenable to have a draft, it's unclear what steps the military and president will be able to take.
Your story, the article, is accompanied by a photo essay that shows medical personnel at work as well as pictures of the survivors' severe injuries. We've posted links to both your article and the photo essay on our website, but I'm wondering, why did you decide it was important to include the photos, some of which I'm sure people will find quite graphic?
Well, in fact, that photo essay was published not by me, but by surgeons from the Walter Reed, and the New England Journal editor had they had agonized about this because those kinds of images from war have not been published in American media. But because they describe a medical story and some lessons that really haven't been seen for the civilian trauma care population, they felt it very important to have them included.
Dr. Atul Gawande speaking with Here and Now's Bob Oakes. Dr. Gawande wrote the article Casualties of War, Military Care for the Wounded in Iraq and Afghanistan. It appears in today's edition of the New England Journal of Medicine. Dr. Gawande is a surgeon at Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston and assistant professor of health policy and management at the Harvard School of Public Health. For a link to his article and to some of the images from the New England Journal of Medicine, go to our website, here-now.org. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Get into your radio and join us again, Here and Now. For a cassette or CD of Here and Now, go to our website, here-now.org, or call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes or CDs are $15 each, which includes shipping and handling.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.